Blog Talk Radio.
You search, you probe, your mind, your spirit becomes weary. You find yourself on a journey to find a talk show, not just an ordinary talk show, but a Christian talk show, unlike anything the mind could fathom. Suddenly, your search comes to an end, for up ahead, there's a signpost, your next stop. Rich Rossi Live Zone.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live. Rod Serling says we search, we probe, and we are so honored today to have our guest Scott Martis coming on shortly. Scott is a person who searches and probes for sea monsters. He has a popular blog talk radio show on the same network on Monster X Radio called Haunted Sea. You could just Google Blog Talk Radio Haunted Sea. Scott also has a GoFundMe for his latest expedition to find Champ. Champ is a monster in the Lake Champlain Lake, which is like upper New York State, also touches into Quebec there in Vermont. And this is a legend that has had many eyewitness accounts, many sightings, and he's the expert on it. I've been fascinated by Champ. Champ has stirred my imagination in recent days. I started writing a fictional story myself about a girl who believes in Champ, and the skeptics give her a hard time about it. But I'm excited to talk to one of the experts on it shortly. So let everyone know to tune in. We are now live. This link is good for anywhere in the world, and also after live broadcasts in perpetuity if any of your friends missed the live broadcast. So we'll be back shortly with Scott Martis.
See, I don't mean to bother you, Doc, but it's a mystery to me why it took so long to get this show on the air. It suddenly ties up all the loose ends with Christian talk. Gee, my wife just loves this show, Doc.
Oh, how we miss Columbo and Peter Falk. We'll be back shortly with the legend of Champ, the mysterious sea monster of Lake Champlain. Here's a little folk song that tells you a little bit about him, and then we'll be right back with Scott Martis.
If you're ever in upper New York State, whether to live or to camp, if you watch carefully, perhaps you may see that handsome lake monster called Champ. Here's to our Lake Champlain monster, the king of the deep and the damp. We'll sing one more chorus to our dinosaurus, that love old creature named Champ. We see him come out in the springtime, as soon as the lake is unfroze. He gives us a scare, popping up here and there, after his long winter doze. Here's to our Lake Champlain monster, the king of the deep and the damp. We'll sing one more chorus to our dinosaurus, that lovable creature named Champ.
That lovable creature named Champ. It says he comes out in the warm weather. Our guest today will be returning to that area when the lake unfreezes and it gets warm in the summer, and leading another expedition. If you go to GoFundMe Lake Champlain Monster Hunt, you can see Scott Martis' latest expedition to find Champ. Well, you can send your questions into richardrossilive@gmail.com as I talk to Scott, or you can also call in a question or comment to the number on your screen, 347-637-2379. That is a New York number. We have some great comments and great support, people listening now in that area as well as all over, but we're having listeners letting us know they're listening in Vermont, New York. A school teacher who I greatly respect has won the Teacher of the Year Award for Best Elementary Teacher, the Kilwins Gift Basket for Best Teacher, and so this is a credible, educated person. Kelly Tabor writes in, I can't wait for this radio broadcast with you and Scott. I am a true believer and tell my students about CHAMP. She teaches fourth grade. Every school year, they are always so intrigued and want to know more about CHAMP. Hopefully some of them can join the program too. Kelly writes, she even had a student that now went to Harvard who, when he got back in touch, asked about CHAMP. So without further ado, let's go to a CHAMP expert here. On line one, welcome Scott Martis.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, Scott. I'm so excited you're here today, and I want to thank you personally for your work because you, obviously think outside the box, and you're willing to dedicate your life to this inquiry. By the way, everybody, Scott's Society Lake Champlain Zoological Inquiry is on the screen there. And it has great information on his website. It has evidence, it has videos, it has photos, it has all kind of scientific data and things like that. It's a website you can peruse for further research. So, Scott, how did you get interested in CHAMP? You were, am I recalling right that you were living in the Vermont area near the lake?
Well, no, I actually moved up there to conduct my cryptozoology research.
Oh, okay.
I am originally from the state of Alabama in the Deep South.
Okay.
Spent most of my early life up until about the time I was 21 there.
Mm-hmm.
And like a lot of kids, I had an interest in dinosaurs. I'm 57 years old now, so I grew up in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s.
Oh, wow, we're the same age, my friend. I just turned 58.
Oh, really?
You beat by a little
bit.
Yeah,
okay. I'll be 58 in December. So anyway, sometime around 1971, 72, I found out about the Loch Ness Monster.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, there might still be plesiosaurs running around, you know, which is not a dinosaur, but it's from that period. Was a contemporary of the dinosaurs, a marine reptile, so that really put the hook in me.
Mm.
And, you know, I spent my childhood reading books and watching documentaries. Do you remember the documentary with Rod Serling around 1974?
Yeah.
About Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster?
Oh, I love that, yeah. They actually...
Yeah, that had a really
when
big
I,
influence
I grew up in
on
Pennsylvania,
me.
Scott, and there was... You may recall this since we're contemporaries, but Jerry Lewis had a chain of kind of small cinemas called Jerry Lewis Cinemas. And they would show things mm-hmm. that they wouldn't show in other theaters, but they actually showed that in the theater. And the little Jerry Lewis, and unfortunately, they didn't stay in business, but I remember going to that theater as excited as you can be. I think it was about 10 or 11 years old.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, when you were a kid, and then Jaws came out, you know, and then
yes,
there was another sea
yes.
monster, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When we were kids, my sister was so scared after Jaws, she didn't even want to sit on a toilet. She was about
she might
7,
get her
8
butt
years
bit
old.
By that shark.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, she was absolutely terrified. Yeah.
Oh, God bless her.
But yeah, I mean, what a great movie. I mean, still to this day, it's just
oh
you know,
yeah.
In a classified
you know what's interesting
anyway.
About that film, Scott, is that Spielberg they had problems with the mechanical shark, and so. He had to kind of improvise. As a filmmaker myself, I know you kind of roll with the punches sometimes. And they, mm-hmm. because of the problems, they didn't show the shark for a long time later in the film. But I think it made it better because of the mystique.
Well, yeah, it was implied.
Yeah.
Whatever horror you were experiencing was coming from your mind. Imagining
yeah.
how bad it was going to be. And the music, it helped too, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The music was half the movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
The music... made half the movie, yeah, so, yeah.
Now, would you say that CHAMP, I know it's CHAMP has been referred to as kind of the American Loch Ness. You brought up Loch Ness. Do you see a lot of great parallels between Loch Ness and CHAMP?
Well, absolutely. I sent you a montage of actual eyewitness sketches, and you look at that, and you see the long neck standing up out of the water and the humps on the back, and...
Yes.
I mean, basically, a lot of people seem to be describing the Loch Ness Monster in America, essentially.
Yes.
So I'm inclined to think that whatever these things are probably at least cousins who probably had an origin somewhere in the North Atlantic, and there was a time period at the end of the Ice Age when all the ice melted that sea levels rose,
mm-hmm.
and both Loch Ness and Lake Champlain were arms of the sea.
Mm, okay, and
so
Lake Champlain obviously does connect to the sea.
Yeah, it still connects to the sea, but at one time it was actually marine. We're talking between 10,000 and 12,500 years ago, very short 2,000-year window, but it was marine during that period. So the idea is that whatever Champ and Nessie are, their ancestry probably came from the North Atlantic, and one group went west and wound up in Lake Champlain, a small population, if they're landlocked. And then another group went east and wound up in Loch Ness. So at the very least, you know, you can make a plausible argument that they have an ancestry and are, if not the same species, maybe subspecies are closely related.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so...
We have a comment from someone that says they're a believer in the Noah flood story and that perhaps the flood displaced different animals from the rising water. So I know some of you believe that.
Well, that's
a worldwide flood literal story. That's a very interesting thought.
Well, there's no doubt, nobody disputes that when all that ice melted, there was just tremendous floods everywhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, 10,000, 13,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And all this melted ice, these glaciers were like miles thick, at least a mile thick, and all that water had to go somewhere. And when it did, it filled up the Great Lakes, and they became basically one piece.
Mm-hmm.
We're all interconnected, even connected to the Mississippi River. And you've got fish that live in Lake Champlain now that originated 6,000 years ago in the Mississippi River Basin,
mm-hmm.
and they migrated north through the Great Lakes and came across as a river that runs across New York State called the Mohawk River. And they migrated into Lake Champlain from a prehistoric version of the Mohawk River. That's where the sturgeons, the gars, the snapping turtles, the mud puppies, the bowfins, all these living fossils that are living in Lake Champlain and in the Great Lakes region, that's how they got there. They came up the Mississippi River and migrated when these places were deeper, and they could do things like that.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah.
Let me throw out, you know, I'm the type of person, it's like there's a committee in my head of all the, I kind of know, like, because we have a very diverse audience, what different people might think or ask as well as the questions coming in. So to take the skeptic, throw a few skeptic questions out, I'm sure you've heard them a trillion times, but what would you say, Scott, to the people that would say, well, these kind of species died out millions and millions of years ago, the plesiosaur, the dinosaurs, and...
Most of the prehistoric candidates, such as the plesiosaurs,
mm-hmm.
prehistoric whale called Bacillosaurus, most of these animals, according to conventional geology, lived and died hundreds and tens of millions of years
mm-hmm.
before humans as we know them existed.
Mm-hmm.
They lived in what you would call the pre-human era of deep time,
mm-hmm.
the Cenozoic era and the Mesozoic era. Well, obviously, the way around that is that you postulate that they have somehow managed to survive in the deep ocean, and we just aren't completely aware of their continued survival yet in the form of a body. Now, some people would even dispute that. Are you familiar with the Zio Maru carcass?
I'm not. Tell me about that. I am familiar with a Japanese serpent that was
That's
called
what I'm talking about. Zio Maru.
Okay. Yeah, because they all said the same thing. That's a myth. It's extinct. And then they found it.
Yeah, well, it's very controversial because a lot of the evidence concerning that carcass points report it being a shark carcass.
Uh-huh.
There were several scientific studies done on it, including biochemical analysis of fibers from one of the flippers, and a lot of that evidence supported the idea that it was simply a mutilated shark carcass, that the jaws mm-hmm. had fallen off, given the misleading impression of a small head and a long neck. However, the whole truth is somewhat more complicated. There were a few holdouts. There was a set of scientific papers published in 1978, and a couple of the authors concluded their paper by saying, there is still no decisive evidence to decide whether the carcass was that of a type of shark or an undescribed reptile. Now, that's not saying a plesiosaur. It's not saying a mosasaur. It's saying some kind of giant marine reptile that we don't know about that resembles fossil forms. So there was some debate there. And there was also another scientist who said, based on the body measurements and body proportions, that they didn't fit any known species of fish or shark. So there was another holdout. And most of the time when you read about that carcass, you'll read that it was proven to be a basking shark, which is not the truth. That's close to the truth, but it wasn't the whole truth.
Hmm.
And those contrary opinions kind of get swept under the rug. But that is the whole truth. So there is a slight possibility. It's very unpopular to say this today, but there is a slight possibility that thing could have been a reptile.
Very interesting. Now, for those who are listening that are unfamiliar with this, the French explorer Samuel de Champlain, founder of Quebec, the lake's named after him, that was the first to claim to have seen him back in the 1600s. So this goes back for a long time, doesn't it?
Well, that's kind of a distortion of a kernel of truth. Let me explain the story about Samuel de Champlain.
Okay.
All right, it's kind of complicated, but let's start in 1970. There was an article published by a folklorist named Marjorie Porter in Vermont Life about the Lake Champlain monster.
Mm.
And she said that Samuel de Champlain had reported seeing a sea serpent when he discovered the lake in 1609.
Mm-hmm.
And it simply is not true. What she took was a kernel of truth from Champlain's journal where he talks about the Western Abenaki Indians having shown him and told him about a fish, which their native name for was Chaalsarau.
Mm-hmm.
And from the description in Champlain's journal, you figure out that what they're describing is a gar, which is a type of fish, a large fish that lives in a lake. It's a living fossil. It has a fossil record going back to the age of the dinosaurs, but it is a known entity. Now, in Champlain's journal, he says that they believe they get between 5 and 8 feet long. Normally, the long-nosed gars, which are smaller than a larger type called the alligator gar, they're found in Lake Champlain. They normally top out at 5 feet, which that's a big fish. And they have a head that looks kind of like an alligator with all these fins going all over the body, and they have kind of a rounded tail fin, and their scales are really hard. The scales are so hard, the Indians used to use their scales for arrowheads.
Wow.
Yeah. People very rarely eat them, but when they do, when they have to clean this fish, they have to use pliers to pull the skin off. That's how tough the hide is.
Yeah, so this is like, you know, those of us that eat lobster, I mean, your crab legs, you've got to really crack that shell, don't you?
Yeah. Well, it's somewhat similar to that. But, yeah, they have a really tough hide with hard scales. So, anyway, there's a larger type of gar called the alligator gar that normally doesn't get any further north in its geographic range than Illinois. But Champlain's description in his journal describes double rows of teeth, which you don't see on a normal long-nosed gar. So there has been some debate about whether what he's describing is a normal long-nosed gar or an alligator gar. Now, these alligator gars get much bigger. There are stories of them getting 11 feet long, and people regularly catch ones that are 8 feet long down in Louisiana and Texas. I mean, these are really, really big fish. And if you saw one, you thought you'd seen a monster. So what I'm getting at here is there's the possibility there might have been alligator gars in Lake Champlain at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But
I've heard
there's
some
no
people
doubt
try to debunk some of the footage, the modern footage, in the same way and say that it could be these long sturgeons or long fish where there's a mother and a baby swimming in sync, and it could be the lumps could just
be
that
does happen.
Long fish.
Especially when they're spawning. You've got you've got a population of landlocked lake sturgeons that can get 7-8 feet long.
Mm.
There was a 7-footer washed up dead almost 5 years ago in one of the islands. And when they're spawning in the springtime, they come into the rivers to spawn, and sometimes they'll travel in groups. And if you see a group of them, you'll see what looks like a bunch of humps. And sometimes you'll see they have these small dorsal fins down toward the end of their tail, and you'll see that too, and it might look like a jagged ridge or something. So I've no doubt that there are some marginal champ sightings that people are seeing either one really large sturgeon or a group of large sturgeons. But that can't account for, you know, these sightings up close where people see a long neck and a snake-like head and the heads move around looking at them and all that kind of stuff, you know? It just doesn't fit.
You
but
know, I
basically
guess
what I'm trying to...
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
What's
that? I'm sorry. I cut you off. Go ahead.
I didn't get that last part.
Oh, no, go ahead. I'm sorry I cut you off. I got anxious to ask you a question, but I think you were still
I was
cut
just
you off.
Finish up about Champlain and the gar. So basically, the general consensus is that what Champlain is describing is some kind of gar pike.
Interesting. Wow. Interesting.
And that Marjorie Porter took that little kernel of truth and distorted it for her story. And ever since that magazine article came out in 1970, people have been perpetuating the distorted version ever since, if you follow me.
Yeah, it's interesting, even though it looks like, from what you're saying, maybe a fake quote. The timing of it was good for Champ's PR, because this is, as you say, with the Rod Serling. I had a little Rod Serling parody thing in the beginning of the show. And this is the Bigfoot, the Patterson footage. So this was in the 70s, and it was kind of an opportune time for us, Champ, to become more popular or more discussed, even though it was through that. But speaking of the 70s, I don't know if it was in the – I think it was in 77 that Sandor Monsi took the famous photograph, the one we see more than any other. And I know people said it could be a floating tree stump, but it sure has that Loch Ness look to it. What's your professional opinion on the Monsi photograph, Scott?
I'm inclined to believe it's an animal.
Mm-hmm.
But now, if you are convinced that there is no such animal and you're trying to explain that picture, the idea of a coincidentally looking piece of wood debris that looks like a dinosaur is a good also-ran.
Mm-hmm.
But if you talk to, see, I knew Sandor Monsi. She died 3 years ago. We were actually friends.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad
I knew her, and I know her kids, too, who were the kids that were there when the picture was taken.
I heard the story that her kids, they were kind of on a picnic playing at the lake when she saw it and took the picture. What do her kids say about that? Do they remember playing and seeing Champ?
Yep. They saw it. Yep. They very rarely go public about it, but, yeah, they did see it. I've spoken to them, and they both say that, yeah, they saw what their mama saw. And Mr. Monsi is dead as well. So
the parents
the only living, the only living witnesses to that incident are the two kids now.
Mm.
And they're,
I'm so glad you got to speak to the kids, Scott, because that's a huge question.
Well,
I'm
friends with them on Facebook.
Great.
I've known them for a while now, so, yeah. So anyway, basically what happened was, and that photograph is really what brought Champ to national attention.
Mm-hmm.
The photograph was allegedly taken July 5th, 1977, somewhere up toward the north end of the lake around St. Albans. It's generally believed to be in somewhere between St. Albans and Alberg, which is kind of a peninsula island way up almost to the Canadian border. So we're talking about the extreme north end of the lake. The story goes, Sandra Manzi was from Vermont originally, her family, and she's buried up in the family plot up way up north in Vermont. So what was going on, her and Mr. Manzi had just gotten married, I believe, and were on their honeymoon, and they had brought her two kids from a previous marriage up to visit family in Vermont, is my understanding. And they were up just driving around looking at the lake up around the North Hero St. Albans area and decided to pull over and, just the kids got in the water and they were just sitting there and then all of a sudden she sees something bubbling up from the water, out further out in the water. She estimated the distance was something like 150 feet. And she's thinking, well, it's a school of fish. And she keeps watching it, and then she's thinking, well, maybe it's scuba divers. And eventually, it starts rising up out of the water, according to what she said. So she sees this tree-looking object, long neck, with what appears to be a head on it and some kind of a back. And she says in several interviews she got the impression of some kind of flippers, possibly, on the other side of the neck, under the water. So she kind of panics, I think it's Mr. Manzi was the first one that kind of panicked and told the kids to get out of the water because he could see it. He was up higher up on the bank than she was, and through some there's several different versions, but somehow he got the camera and gave the camera to her, which is one of those little, remember those Instamatic cameras, Kodak Instamatics?
Yeah.
That they had back in the 70s, used the Kodachrome and the Ektachrome film, one of those.
Yeah.
And handed her the camera and she took one picture. And then they left. They were just, in shock, I guess.
Wow.
But she only managed to get the one picture. And a lot of people have been critical about that. But, how often everybody in their lives, has startling experiences that happen, just boom, they're on you, and then it's over.
Yeah. So this picture, I guess, in a way for me is almost analogous to the Patterson Bigfoot film. I mean, this is like the big one.
Yeah, I mean,
that
it's
really
a major piece of evidence, no doubt.
Yeah, it really blows up.
Yeah, I mean, it looks for all the world, you look at it, it looks like if you went back in a time machine 60, 70 million years ago and took a picture of a plesiosaur at the surface, looking over its back, that's what it would look like probably.
Wow.
I mean, if that's...
kind of this famous woman. I mean, isn't it amazing the one picture kind of, makes her a well-known name in these circles, and it's probably like the obituary thing that she's remembered for.
Yeah. Well, more power to her, I mean, everybody wants to be remembered for something, and I could think of a lot of worse things to be remembered for,
Yeah. It's really exciting.
But anyway, you know, you just look at the photograph. I mean, and it, you know, it looks to me like, you just look at it, you know how you look at things and you get feelings about them. To me, it just looks like an animal.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there's no way that that could possibly be a sturgeon doing some kind of weird contortion with its tail or anything like that.
No,
You can throw that interpretation out the window.
Yeah. But you have that long neck coming out.
Yeah. I mean, I've really looked at, you know, a lot of people have argued that, well, a plesiosaur wouldn't be able to contort its neck like that because of the way that their neck vertebrae are built. And I've looked into that question, and I don't think that is the case. Mm. Because they seem to have had quite a bit of side-to-side neck flexibility and up-and-down neck flexibility and the ability to turn their neck backwards and also at the same time raise it up. So I believe they would be able to make their neck into that configuration. And another interesting thing is that I found a photograph of a Asian water monitor lizard sitting on a bank, and it's got a head that's in shadow, this one particular picture, and it looks exactly like the head part of the Monzi photograph. It's amazing, the resemblance. I mean, it was the same head. So.
Wow. Well, Scott,
yeah,
we'll do
so
a little program identification and come right back to you. And anyone that wants to send in a question, send it to richardrossilive@gmail.com or call the number on your screen, 347-637-2379. And we'll be right back with Scott Martis and go deeper into the story of Champ. We'll be right back in a minute with Scott and more Champ.
Can you hear me?
347-637-2379. Richard, can you hear me?
I know what you're thinking. Since the phone lines are all busy, should I or shouldn't I keep calling? Well, if I were you, I'd keep trying. Go ahead and make your day.
The Legend of Champ. We'll be right back.
No.
You can call in your
only
question or email it in for Scott. We'll be right back with Scott.
Because we start at 3:30, so.
Now Champ is a famous attraction. Oh, yes. He sure is a tourist delight. They come up in droves to examine our coves and take pictures by day and by night. Here's to our Lake Champlain monster, the king of the deep and the dam. We'll sing one more chorus to our dinosaurus, that lovable creature named Champ.
Welcome back. We're talking about Champ, the Lake Champlain monster, and this program will be good to replay if any of your friends miss it. The lake monster living in Lake Champlain, a 125-mile body of water shared by New York, Vermont, Quebec. Scott Martis has been investigating this, and you can get a lot of great information on his site, which is on the screen, or just Google Lake Champlain Zoological Inquiry. He has a GoFundMe. You could search GoFundMe for Lake Champlain Monster Hunt, which will fund the next summer expedition. And Scott also has a blog talk radio show on the same network called Haunted Sea. And we have some questions coming in here. Let's see here. Question coming in from Carl in Cleveland says, with the proliferation of cell phone cameras that most have now, will the photographic evidence increase of Champ, and wouldn't it be likely to get even better pictures than the that we've had before because everyone has a camera practically? What do you say, Scott? Do you think that we should see an increase due to more people having cell phones? Have you noticed that increasing footage?
Well, there's actually a cell phone video was shot as recently as 2009 that's claimed to be Champ, which is a really intriguing piece of footage, which is called the Olsen video.
Yeah, I saw on your zoological site, there was one I thought was really good. That I think that was it. There was a top one, and then I thought the second one down was even better. I'm on
what you
site,
see in the Olsen video.
ICTI.org.
What you see in the Olsen video is a silhouette of a turtleish-looking animal.
Mm-hmm.
When it first comes on the video, and then as the video progresses, the head and the neck portion come up more, and it's kind of ambiguous. That when you first see in the video, it looks like a turtle.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have tried to argue that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. That one just blew me away. If you
guys go to LCCI.org,
click under evidence, click video evidence. It's the second one down. I thought that was the best one I've seen yet.
Yeah, that was shot with a cell phone.
Was it?
Early one morning. Yeah, the guy that shot it, Eric Olson, he's a graphic designer that lives in Burlington, Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
Lives around the corner from that park. It's called Oak Ledge Park, right on the lake. And he was used to making an early morning walk around there. It's a beautiful place as the sun's coming up. And the sun was coming. This was like 6 a.m. in the morning, May 31st, 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And he just happens to look around, and there's this thing comes swimming up next to a buoy. It comes moving toward the shore, and then it goes under the water and disappears.
Mm.
The whole thing is like
just
20 seconds, and it's over, you know?
Yeah.
So he just happened to be at the right place at the right time, and he got that intriguing video.
Well, as I'm watching it right now as we speak on Scott's site, by the way, LCZI.org, I can hear the skeptics saying with this in the Monzi photograph that the water would be too shallow for a massive creature.
Actually been in the water there and investigated that site several times. It's deep enough for something to get in.
Yeah, the Monzi photo, would that be the same? The water would be deep enough?
Yep. There's portions of the water around there that are 20 feet deep, so yeah, it's...
Yeah, and plus, I don't know that assumption's naturally true, even if it was more shallow, because, sharks are huge, and here in Southern California, the shark attacks tend to be in the shallow water, even though they're big animals. That's where a lot of times they come into and get, and, you know, when people are attacked, it's more shallow.
Something interesting, based on the investigations I've been doing here in Florida, of some of the Florida monsters. There's a river, largest river in Florida, called the St. Johns River. There's been monster sightings of something all up and down the entire 300-mile stretch of this river. And there was a cluster of sightings in a place called Astor, Florida, in 1953. And we were over there a couple of weeks ago doing some filming and investigating around... a large portion of the river that's called Lake George. It's not really a lake. It's just a bay of the river.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been, you know, lots of sightings in that area. And the interesting thing is the general water depth there is between 7 and 5 feet. Now, you would think at first, well, that's just absolutely ridiculous. And then you start digging around and you find out that sometimes there are 14-foot alligators in that water and 15-foot manatees. And as well, people catch these 9- and 10-pound largemouth bass in this area, too. So, obviously, it can support very large animals. And the whole time we were there all day long, we never saw an alligator or a manatee. I'm sure there were gators hiding under the water lily somewhere, but I wasn't about to jump in the water and find out, you know?
Wow.
But that just goes to show you that, you know, your assumptions may not necessarily be right.
Calling in a question here from Ticonderoga, New York, a question from Darren.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
And we took down the question here. Darren Addison, Ticonderoga, says that there are actual laws on the books protecting the hunting or harming or killing of Champ. And is that an acknowledgement of Champ, or is it a bit tongue-in-cheek, or a combination of both that they actually have laws protecting
Champ? Well, it depends on depends on who you talk to, you know?
Uh-huh.
I think it's largely, the laws don't really have a whole lot of teeth in them,
mm-hmm.
but they kind of stand as, you know, as a warning to people that, hey, you know, you can't just come up here and mess around with what may or may not be in our lake, you know?
Yes, and it's like, you know, people say the same with Bigfoot, so they get a Bigfoot corpse and prove it, but, you know, if this is like the Japan situation where people thought, oh, it's a cryptid, it's a myth, and then they find the thing, you know, the worst, you know, if this is a species that has been somewhat hidden. Now, the fact that it's been sighted over a long period of time, I mean, this is might sound like a stupid question, but to me it seems like an obvious question is that are we talking about a group of these species that are multiplying rather than one that has this longevity that's been around so long? Or?
Well, if it's an animal, which I'm inclined to think it is, that's almost certainly got to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a few people on the fringe that think that there's some kind of supernatural entity. I've never bought into that idea, but, you know, it's a free country. I don't find it very compelling. The theories have been put forth to support that idea. But so if it's a real animal, you've got two choices. You've got to say, well, it's a marine animal that comes in occasionally from the sea and then goes back out, or there's a population of these animals that have been trapped in the lake since the time it was marine.
Mm-hmm.
And the mechanism to explain how they could have got trapped is like this. It's called isostatic rebound. Now, I'm about mm-hmm. to explain that to you.
Okay.
Okay, when these massive glaciers during the Ice Age came down into places like Canada and New England, as I said before, they were miles thick. Now, that's enough weight to weigh down the continental plates that sit on a bed of lava underneath the earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know how the continental plates move around?
Yeah.
And that in the past, the continents were in different regions geographically
mm-hmm.
because they have moved?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, they sit on a layer of lava and float around. So when these glaciers came down, they actually weighed down the continental plates. They sunk down lower than they normally would be.
Uh-huh.
Then the ice melted, and as a combination of all this excess water and the fact that the continental plates were lower than they normally were, is what caused the rise in sea level and also water to come into places that it normally wouldn't have come into because the land was lower. So anyway, it took time for the land to bounce back up, but it slowly did start to bounce back up. And there was a point around 10,000 years ago that the land rose. And when it rose, it cut off the marine influence to Lake Champlain, and the water turned to fresh water over a period of time. So whatever was living in there, in what is now Lake Champlain, got trapped.
Mm.
Either it adapted to fresh water or it died out. Now we know that some of the fish that live in the lake now managed to survive from that time period because the genetics studies on these fish species suggest that they are native to what is now Lake Champlain, so that means that they were their ancestors were living in this marine environment.
So they're kind of sitting under these glaciers, this ice, prior to the melting, and then survived.
Well, they had to, anything that was living in the area where the glaciers came down, either got buried under the ice and died, or fled south.
Mm-hmm.
Fled to what they call glacial refugiums, or refugia. There was an area up at the extreme northern end of Canada, around Alaska. It's referred to in the geology literature as Beringia. That was an ice-free region. There was an ice-free corridor between the two major ice sheets, the one on the west coast and the one on the east coast, that came down into North America, and they believe that's where prehistoric man crossed over the land bridge from Asia and came down into North America through that so-called ice-free corridor, which would have been somewhere around Montana.
Wow.
So there were areas, and as far as the glaciers got south was Long Island. So everything from Long Island down was ice-free. But the temperature was much lower than it is today. Let's say Florida probably at that point in time at the height of the Ice Age probably had a climate like Pennsylvania does today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so world temperatures were much lower during the Ice Age. And a lot of places that are now underwater were water-free. And the reason why is that so much of that water was sucked up into the ice sheets.
Mm.
But when it all started melting, that was a different story. What is now Lake Champlain was a fjord in a much larger sea called the Champlain Sea. And most of the sea was up in Quebec and Ontario, Canada, which is right across the border. You know, the northern end of Lake Champlain is in Quebec.
Mm.
About 4 miles of it, of the lake, the northern extreme end of it, of Missisquoi Bay, is in Canada. So they have found fossil whale skeletons and seal bones all over Quebec and Ontario from this marine sea. They found whale bones of a beluga whale in Charlotte, Vermont in 1849. That is the Vermont State Fossil. And you can go see it in Burlington, Vermont at the Perkins Geology Museum. It's in a glass case. And they've also found seal bones in Plattsburgh, New York, which is right across the other side of the lake. So there were not just large fish living in this sea, but there were actual whales and seals and your regular cold water marine animals living in it. And the idea is that whatever Champ is was probably living there too.
Mm. Wow,
so
fascinating.
The alternative idea is that there could be something coming and going from the sea. Now, the problem with that is that you go to the northern end of Lake Champlain, you run into a river called the Richelieu River. You go north on the Richelieu River in Quebec, you eventually come to the St. Lawrence River. You make a right onto the St. Lawrence River, and you come out at the Gulf of St. Lawrence, which is around Nova Scotia. And that's a distance of like 600 miles. So if Champ's going to come in from the ocean from that direction, he's got to travel 600 miles, going from Nova Scotia all the way across Canada, and then come down into Lake Champlain on that Richelieu River. Now, there are occasional reports of monsters on the St. Lawrence River, and there's a long history of them, but you would think if something was regularly coming and going through there, there would be more of a history of it.
Mm-hmm.
And on the Richelieu River, you've got a system of two dams and a canal system, too. So whatever's going to try to get in, it's got to negotiate those dams. There's a significant change in elevation in one of them. There's a drop of 16 feet, which is nothing to laugh at, you know. So whatever's coming and going has got to negotiate an elevation change of 16 feet. It's either got to jump over it or fall down it. So going down to the southern end of Lake Champlain, to the very extreme end, you've got Whitehall, New York. Now, Whitehall, New York, there's the Champlain-Hudson Canal, which is an artificially built connection built back during the early 1800s of canal gates going from the southern end of Lake Champlain into the Hudson River. So anything coming from the Hudson River at New York, which would be Long Island Sound, would have to swim 300 miles up the Hudson River and then negotiate those, I believe it's 10 or 11 canal locks to get into Lake Champlain. So, but now, a few years ago, a seal tried to get in, but they caught it before it got in. So, and there is a history of several seals getting in to Lake Champlain in the 1800s. So it's not impossible.
Wow.
So
well, after this next station break, Scott, we're going to ask you some more questions coming in, and also we will want to hear about your expeditions as well. So we'll be right back with Scott in another minute. Thank you, everyone, for joining this fascinating exploration into the great sea monster of Lake Champlain, Champ. And he's a good guy. He's not a scary guy like Jaws. We love Champ. We'll be right back to learn more about Champ. And you can email your questions to us at richardrossilive@gmail.com or call your question to our phone line, 347-637-2379. We'll be right back with Scott. The legend of Lake Champlain.
Listen here, Pilgrim, and listen good. Why don't you mosey on over and set that down to Rich Rossi Live? When it comes to Christian talk, he'll wrestle you up a show with true grit.
Rich Rossi Live.
The legend of Lake Champlain and Champ, a sea monster, a Loch Ness, America's Loch Ness. And we are been talking with Scott Martis. He has so much evidence on his site. So everyone visit Lake Champlain Zoological Inquiry and check out what he's doing. And we'll be right back with Scott to talk more.
Since that traveler Samuel Champlain, since he wrote out that line back in 1609, lots of people have seen him again. Here's to our Lake Champlain monster, the king of the deep and the dam. We'll sing one more chorus to our dinosaurus, that lovable creature named Champ. There's a fellow named Joseph Zarzynski, a man who is friendly and warm. He's proposing some laws to protect Champ because he is anxious to save him from harm.
Well, we were just talking about the laws that are on the books that protect Champ from being hunted or hurt. And we have someone who has dedicated his life and made different expeditions. I guess the $20 million question, and forgive me for asking it, I'm sure you get asked it all the time, is if on your expeditions, if you believe that you've seen Champ, Scott, and if so, can you tell us about that?
Well, I believe I've had one sighting of something that I couldn't explain that I believe was probably one of these animals in July of 1994, not long, a few months after I moved up there. Unfortunately, at the time, I didn't have a camera, but the day it happened, I did go home and make sketches while it was still fresh in my memory. I did have a set of binoculars, and I was watching this thing through binoculars. This happened at a place called Battery Park in Burlington, Vermont, which sits up on a bluff over one of the widest parts of the lake. It was like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I happened to be looking out toward a place called Rock Dunder, which is a little small island that sits out in Burlington Bay there. And is sacred to the Indians, the Western Abenaki. They believe it's a personification of their god, Adzioso, which we don't really have time to explain all that. But anyway, it's a sacred Indian site. Anyway, I happened to be looking out about 1,000 yards to the west of Rock Dunder. There's some buoys. And later on, I found out that there's a shipwreck out there, and that's what those buoys are there for, is to mark that shipwreck. So I happened to look out, and I saw this mound-like object come bobbing up from under the water near that buoy. And I just can describe it as being a garbage bag color, a greeny black.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a large mound resembling, say, maybe a turtle's back.
Mm.
And then there was a smaller object in the center of that that was also protruding up. And this whole incident took place in a matter of, like, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 seconds, and it was over. So I'm watching this through the binoculars, and the object turns to the right to where the smaller object is now on the right end of that mound, and it starts swimming to the right, and it's kind of got a bouncing, bobby motion to it. And the general impression I get is that this is some animal swimming on its side, and this smaller object sticking up in the air is a flipper, and it's swimming on its side. Now, I could be mistaken about that, because the general shape, once it turned to that orientation, was very similar to what you see at the beginning of the Olsen video. So it's possible that what I mistook or interpreted as a flipper was actually a head on a somewhat short neck. I just don't know. It happened so fast. But anyway, I was watching it through binoculars, so there was no question in my mind what I was seeing. It was some strange object that looked like a weird animal, right?
Yeah.
So it swims to the right for a few seconds and then stops and then sinks like a rock, and it's gone. It's over. The whole thing's over. 15, 20
well, this,
seconds.
This harkens back to what you said earlier, Scott, about sometimes these things happen so quick, and so people that were judgmental of a Monzi photograph, the woman was watching these kids play at, you know, at the lake, and she only had a limited amount of time. The fact she grabbed the camera and got that shot is remarkable.
Well, think about the people sitting in Dallas the day that Kennedy got shot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What are they going to do except sit there and look and react? They're in shock, you know. It's just, boom, there it is. It happened, it's over.
Mm.
You know? It's one of those type things, you know.
Well, we have an important correction here from our school teacher I mentioned earlier, who is from the Crown Point area, and she says we need to change the language that CHAMP is not America's Loch Ness. CHAMP's number one, so we need to start referring to Loch Ness as Scotland's CHAMP.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Correction noted,
that.
And we will.
Yeah.
I like that.
Well, as a long time advocate for CHAMP, I can support that idea. Yeah. Definitely.
Okay. Great. Well, tell us about your upcoming expedition, Scott, and you're raising some funds on GoFundMe. Could you tell us about what you have planned?
Well, it's still very much in the planning stages at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The plan is for at least 2 weeks, possibly a little more. And as you've noticed from the Lake Champlain Zoological Inquiry website, we actually have a team now of people that I have worked with on various projects over the years. We decided to get together and actually form a research team. And we're all very busy people, and so we're not going to all 8 of us be there at one time.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to kind of try to set up a central camp somewhere and sort of do the tag team thing. I'm going to be there the whole time,
mm-hmm.
but they'll be coming in drips and drabs in groups of 2 or 3 or whatever, and we'll just be going out doing various projects. Two things we want to do. There were a lot of sightings around the St. Albans area, which is up north end of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
There were 2 photographs and a video shot.
Wow.
In a fairly close time period late last summer. And there was an interesting sighting a man had further south from there near Colchester, Vermont. He was out on his boat and saw something on his sonar, and then saw this giant turtleish-looking back come up and then sink back down.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to try to look into all those. There's been a lot of debate about exactly where Sandra Monzi's photograph was taken. But there are two very promising places, and we're going to do further investigation of those with divers and underwater cameras and all that stuff and sonar. I think it's highly likely that one of these sites, and they're all, both of them are in the same general area, is the actual place where the photograph was taken. So we're going to see what's down there, you know. And speaking about videos, there's a very intriguing video that was shot in 2005 that you may have seen, and it's somewhere on the website called the Baudet video. Mm-hmm. This was shot in 2005 on the New York side of the lake at the mouth of the Au Sable River. So we want to try to get back over there and do some more underwater investigation there, too. So,
yeah, I think that's the first one you have on your site. And if you're, if those of you want to do more research, you can see all the videos at Scott's Scott's wonderful site, which is the Lake Champlain Zoological Inquiry, LCZI.org. It's on the radio show. And click evidence, and that's the first video there, followed by the Olson video we referenced earlier.
The intriguing part of the Baudet video is you see a section where you're looking over the side of a boat, you see a boat rail, and you see some kind of object or animal right over the side of the boat, barely under the water, and you see what looks like a snake-like head and a neck moving. The head changes orientation, or what looks like a head, and then some kind of a flipper-like object comes out on the left side of that neck and head object. And it looks very much like the head and the neck of a plesiosaur.
We have a question coming in from a family in New York. Let me read this. Have you ever searched in the Bawaga Bay area in Port Henry, New York?
Yes. Not recently, but the last time I was over there was 2017, I believe. Yeah.
2017. And camp activity there in Bawaga Bay?
Well, there still is, yeah. I mean, lots of sightings. It was a really impressive amphibious sighting where a guy, I think, and his brother claimed to have seen it sitting on a rock.
Mm.
And what they described sounds very much like a plesiosaur.
Mm. Wow.
And if you want more information about that, there is a mini-series that one of the members of my team did for Small Town Monsters called On the Trail of Champ.
Mm-hmm.
It's somewhere on YouTube. It's a 5-part docu-series. And they interview the guy that saw it sitting on the rock at Port Henry.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a very good introduction to some of the work we've been doing over the last few years. One idea that I've been trying to pursue is to actually try to find physical evidence of a dead one. So we've been searching for underwater caves, potential underwater caves, and we've also been looking for caves that are above water now that would have been underwater during the time of the Champlain Sea. So far, we've got 3 of them. So the idea is to look in the bottom of these caves that are above water now, digging mm-hmm. around for bones of ones that might have died thousands of years ago when these caves were underwater.
Mm. That's a great idea.
So what I'm saying is
take refuge in that cave, and maybe that would be a great, great idea.
Yeah. So, and the other idea is if you go to my website and you or to the GoFundMe thing, you see a picture of me holding a pole.
Yeah.
And what that is, it's a pole with a biopsy dart on the end of the pole. And the idea is that if we can get close enough to one of these things in a boat, they use these things all the time in whale and shark research, it might be possible to gently reach over and touch the animal with this pole and get a very small piece of tissue
uh-huh.
from one. and you could get all kinds of DNA evidence from that little piece of tissue. It's totally
wow.
harmless. They do this in shark and whale research all the time for genetic studies. It just gets a little tiny plug of tissue, which you can get all kinds of genetic information from.
Yeah, I'm looking
so
at that photo of you, Scott,
small,
and you're holding
yep.
it in your hands there. And how
yeah.
long is that? It looks like it might be several feet.
Yeah, it's just an extension pole for, I think, for, like, painting. And I modified
yeah,
and it and put
so you can actually lengthen
it
out
it.
If need be. If you couldn't quite
yeah.
get to champ, you could lengthen it out as you're in the boat.
Yeah, well, when they tried for years to do something like this at Loch Ness, and they never could get close enough to one to do it.
Yeah.
There are more expensive devices. They make crossbows that can shoot the dart, and you can retrieve it back with a piece of rope. And they even make air guns that you can shoot the dart with an air gun. But I just, at this point in time, I can't afford that technology. So, you know, there's also the environmental DNA route, which they started doing at Loch Ness, which they're actually getting dead skin cells out of the water that have been shed by different animals and analyzing that and getting DNA strands from that.
Mm.
That's still a work in progress. Now they have a portable environmental DNA kit to which you can get a sample from the water and test it on that portable kit and run it against samples of known animals and get some kind of results within minutes. But again, this technology is very expensive and is just beyond my, you know, ability to afford at this point, maybe someday. But the idea is this primitive technique that I'm using, if we could get close enough to one, we could get a piece of a tissue sample, we could freeze it and send it off somewhere and get it analyzed.
I love that, Scott.
And it probably wouldn't qualify as a type specimen, but it would still be a step in the right direction.
Wow.
It would bolster the case that Champ is an animal of some sort. And might be enough to get the scientific community that is currently skeptical engaged in this question. So, I don't know.
Another question coming in from Mark in Indianapolis said he had read, this is switching to Loch Ness for a moment, but read that the famous Loch Ness photo was debunked as fake. And, you know, we hear stories on like, different things like the Shroud of Turin. One month they say it's fake, another month they say it's been proven real. And I know the Champ photo, the infamous photo, we talked about the Monzi photo being argued both ways. What do you think of the famous Loch Ness photo that someone claimed someone built?
Well, obviously he's talking about the surgeon's photo from 1934 and the claim
right.
that it was made with a model on a toy submarine. Well,
right.
Okay, the newspapers at the time ran with that story, and it was all over, splashed all over the media.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, the entire case is based on the verbal testimony of two people. There is absolutely no physical evidence whatsoever to back up the story. And a lot of people, me included, believe that this was a story made up by two brothers to try to rehabilitate their father's reputation. Their father was a guy named Marmaduke Wetherell that in 1934 allegedly was hired by the Daily Mail newspaper to go look for the Loch Ness Monster. A couple of days after he got there, this was around Christmas of 1933, he discovered footprints on the beach that look kind of like the footprints you see of a hippo or an elephant or possibly of a sauropod dinosaur. A Brontosaurus-type dinosaur had very similar footprints. So anyway, this guy, after a couple of days, finds these footprints on a beach and takes plaster casts of them and sends them off to the London Museum of Natural History. People are waiting over the Christmas holiday to get the results of what the story is on these footprints. So eventually, the London Natural History Museum comes back and says, these are our faked footprints made with a stuffed hippopotamus footprint, foot, and turns out later on that Wetherill had an ashtray that was made of a hippo's foot. And it's believed now that that's what he used to fake these footprints. So anyway, Wetherill was embarrassed, and the Daily Mail fired him and sent him back. And the story is that these two sons claim that Wetherill concocted this hoax to get revenge on the Daily Mail, and that with some friends, he got this London surgeon, Kenneth Wilson, to claim to have taken the photographs. It's a very complicated, convoluted story that's got two or three different versions. The original story that Wetherill's son said, the initial claim, he claimed that a totally different kind of camera was used, which doesn't add up. And then if you take all the different compartmentalized versions of the story, the only way this works is that supposedly Wetherill's stepson, a guy named Christian Sperling, which would have been his actual son's half-brother, took and made a plastic wood carved sea serpent neck and put it on top of a 10-toy submarine and then put weights on the submarine to give it balance with the neck on there. And they took that to a small bay. Ian Wetherill and Marmaduke Wetherill took that model to a small bay in Loch Ness and photographed it, then allegedly destroyed the toy submarine, which we have no physical evidence for at all. And then the story is they used a friend, a guy, an insurance salesman named Maurice Chambers, took and re-photographed their photographs onto what they call a quarter plate camera, which is an awkward type of camera which uses, instead of a roll of film, uses these photographic plates that you have to pull in and out the bottom of the camera rather than a roll of film, if you follow me.
Mm-hmm.
So the story is that they re-photographed the photographs that they made with a different camera, and then Chambers gave the re-photographed prints on this plate camera to this Dr. Wilson, and then Dr. Wilson claimed to have photographed it and ran to the photographic chemist shop in Loch Ness and had the pictures developed. So the original account was that Kenneth Wilson, the doctor, happened to be driving by Loch Ness very early in the morning on his way to a wildfowl shoot that him and this Chambers guy owned up in the north of Scotland, and then here pops up the Loch Ness Monster, and he photographed it twice. Tried to take four photographs, but only two came out. And one problem with the hoax claim is it doesn't address the second photograph. That just gets kind of brushed under the rug, but there are actually two photographs, and this head and neck-lock object is in a different position in the second photograph. So there are so many holes in this hoax claim that I'm inclined to believe that the original claim is probably the truth, and that these two Wetherill brothers made up this story after the fact sometime in the 1970s, and that nobody took the bait until the early 1990s.
Yeah, I noticed, Scott, with it, you know, as you know, papers are in the business to sell stories and make money. So if there's a story, you know, a famous Loch Ness photo debunked, that's, of course,
going to
be carried
all over the world. Well, yeah, I mean, they're looking to sell papers, and the people that did the investigation and spoke to Christian Sperling liked the story so much, I think they weren't critical enough of some of the holes in the story, and it was a combination of those two factors together that made people believe, because it was splashed all over the newspapers, they took it as it had been a proven fact, and that is not the case. I'm not saying that the hoax claim is complete garbage, but there are a lot of holes in that story. There are enough holes in the story that you can really question it. So let's just put it that way. I mean, I wasn't there in 1934. I don't know, but I'm just telling you, based on looking at the whole picture and all the different claims, whether it's Wilson's original claim or the hoax claim, I'm more inclined to believe that it's an authentic photograph of something.
Yeah,
so.
I've seen these hoax claims go back and forth, and then a year later someone will, oh, I have proof it was real. And it, yeah, and it seems like
the proponents of the hoax claim have written a book. It's called The Surgeon's Photograph Exposed. There are plenty of used copies of it floating around on Amazon and eBay. You should be able to find a copy of it.
Mm.
That is the best summary of the hoax claim out there, is that book. And then to hear the other side of the argument, there's a documentary, probably the best documentary ever made on the Loch Ness Monster, in my opinion, for the television series Nova. It's called The Beast of Loch Ness. This is from 1999, and there's a real good section about the alternative arguments on that. So if you really want to look into this deeper, I would suggest consulting those two sources.
Wow. Well, thanks for the great reference there. And we'll be right back for our conclusion of the show with Scott. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Richard Rossi Live. We're talking about CHAMP today. CHAMP, the legend of the sea monster of Lake Champlain, and we'll be back for give Scott our last words here.
To our Lake Champlain monster, the king of the deep and the damp, we'll sing one more chorus to our dinosaurus, that lovable creature named CHAMP. If you should meet up with dear Champy, now I'll tell you just what to say. Look him straight in the eye and smile and say, hi, we're so glad that you've come here to stay. Here's to our Lake Champlain monster, the king of the deep and the damp. We'll sing one more chorus to our dinosaurus, that lovable creature named CHAMP. The best place to see our dear monster is outside the Bullwaga Bay Bar. After having a few, you may even see two, but then don't try to drive in your car. Here's to our Lake Champlain monster, the king of the deep and the damp. We'll sing one more chorus to our dinosaur, that lovable creature.
Well, in answer to one of the questions that came in about the boat, about the bay, they answered that song. They said the best place to see CHAMP is the Bawaga Bay. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I want to give the final words to Scott, our esteemed guest, and I want to encourage all of you to look at his sites for further evidence and research. Go to his Lake Champlain Zoological Inquiry. And also he has a GoFundMe, Lake Champlain Monster Hunt, and he hosts a show on Blog Talk Radio called Haunted Sea. So why don't you wrap up in a few minutes, Scott, any last words about CHAMP? And I'm really glad that you've come on the show today, and I hope that we'll be able to stay in touch on this. So just share with
absolutely.
Our audience anything about CHAMP or any way to keep up with what you're doing.
Well, you know, I've got three Facebook groups. I've got one that's more of a generalized forum, which covers CHAMP, the Loch Ness Monster, other lake monsters, and sea serpents, called the Zombie Plesiosaur Society. Then there's my main CHAMP group, which I established a few years back with my late research partner, William Dragunas. And that's called Lake Champlain Monster Research by Scott Martis, William Dragenis. And then there's the Facebook group for the new group, which is called the Lake Champlain Zoological Inquiry with an I. So if you join any one of those three groups, you should pretty much well be able to keep up with what's going on. So, and we
have
a website.
Would you mind asking those again, Scott, just because I know folks, sometimes they're driving or it's on their cell phone. Would you just repeat all the groups for us?
All right. The first one is the Zombie Plesiosaur Society.
Okay.
The second
Zombie.
One is called, yeah.
Zombie
Plesiosaur. Yeah. The second one is called CHAMP, Lake Champlain Monster Research by Scott Martis, William Dragenis. And the third one is the Lake Champlain Zoological Inquiry with an I.
Okay. So I'm going to keep up with these myself. Okay. I'm not as techie as some, so I'm a little bit. Forgive my slowness, but the fact that I'm slow is going to help everybody else listening because they're probably faster than me. So I've got Zombie Plesiosaur Society. Give me the second one again.
CHAMP Lake Champlain Monster Research by Scott Martis / William Dragenis, Dragenis.
Okay, let me find that one. Well, that first group had 12,000 members. Wow. Okay, so I found the other one, CHAMP. That one has over 1,000. You got a great following on this.
Yeah.
I think I might have already joined that one. Yeah, I already joined
yeah.
that one. Okay,
I think
and,
that's where we met.
Yeah, that's where we met. What's the third one, Scott?
The Lake Champlain Zoological
right?
Inquiry. Yep. We have a Facebook group and a web page. A regular internet web page.
Lake Champlain yeah. Zoological. Oh my!
Inquiry with an I.
Calling or killing me over my butchering zoological. Lake Champlain Zoological Inquiry.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. And I do have,
I have
web-
a book on Amazon too.
Oh, tell us the book title.
It's called. I can't remember the name of my own book. Hang on a minute here. Oh, Night of the Living Dead Plesiosaurs.
Oh, my God. I love the title because I grew up in Western PA where the original iconic
Pittsburgh was
George
where
Romero
the movie
film
was
filmed. Shot.
Yeah. Yep. That's where, yep, in Pittsburgh, yep.
Yeah, in fact, I've
I think Dawn of the Dead was filmed there at a mall, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, one of the sequels. And I've had John Russo... who produced and wrote, co-produced and co-wrote the film, has been on my show, and some of the folks involved in producing that film got me involved in filmmaking. And
did you ever meet Mr. Rogers?
Oh, I sure did, yes, yes. In fact, when I was a little boy, I was honored to visit his show in the land of make-believe. And
when I was a kid, man, I loved that show.
Oh, he was so nurturing. And
great guy. Absolutely.
Yeah, I've done a show on
anybody's got anything bad to say about Mr. Rogers, he's got problems, you know?
Yeah. I'm friends with Lady Aberlin, Betty Aberlin. She's a wonderful woman.
Oh, yeah,
woman.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And Handyman Negri was a jazz guitar player.
Oh, he's great, yeah. In fact, he's been in our circles because my father was a jazz guitarist. They were like the two best jazz guitarists in Pittsburgh when I was growing up, and I used to play in the jazz
yeah.
clubs with my dad. And Joe Negri's great. And
yeah.
I did a show on Fred Rogers, excuse me. I did a show on Fred Rogers with a woman that's the president of the seminary in Pittsburgh where he went, which is Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, because he was a Presbyterian minister, as you know. And we talked about, you know, his just kind of his Christ-like approach and everything he did, you know. There's a quote I think about a lot with him. In fact, as my son had brought it up the other day, where he said, if you want a child to be good, you treat them and tell them they're good, you know. And I thought about, you know, how Christ would tell people, you are the light of the world, you are the salt of the earth, and just affirm people with these kind of statements. And he was like that. I would, as a kid, watching him telling us, you're special, there's no one like you. In fact, I'll send you, since you're a fellow guitar player, I recently did a song of his myself on my guitar, and I'll put it up on YouTube, and I'll send it to you. It's the one, it's you I like. And
yep.
I want to send it
I
to
remember.
You, Scott. I'll message it to you because I know you're a musician as well. And I
yep.
hope you like my rendition of it. I was really honored that Lady Aberlin, Betty Aberlin, who, of course, is iconic and was on the show like 30 years,
oh, yeah.
she really loved my rendition of it. I just did it on my cell phone, you know, playing
yeah.
it. But I'll send it to you right now. But I'm really grateful you've been on the show, Scott.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on. I, there's never enough time to discuss everything, but I think we've got some interesting points in, you know.
Yeah, we sure did. And this will be shared. This link's going to be shared a lot up in that area and get some more
right.
awareness and support for your worthy endeavors. And
yeah.
You know, and we'll keep going with this. I have a tremendous fascination, so I hope we can stay in touch, Scott. I just sent you my Mr. Rogers song, It's You I Like. I hope you like my version, and take the words to heart.
Thank you.
Because it's you we like,
yep.
Scott. It's you're special just for being you and for doing something different that I'm sure there are detractors, and you're doing something really special, and I'm really grateful you were on the show.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, Scott. We'll stay in touch, and God bless you, my
yep.
friend. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Same to you.
Yes, thanks, everybody, for listening, especially all those in the Vermont and New York and Quebec area. You all keep looking for Champ. Get ready with those cell phones so you can get some pictures and video for us, okay? God bless you all.